Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the newly branded OTA On The Air. I'd like to take an opportunity to thank our presenting sponsor, Transport Services. They have stepped up to the plate for us in that. And Transport Services is a full-service semi-trailer with locations in Cleveland and Columbus. Since its inception in 1976, Transport Services has grown to over 80 employees and continues to expand. Transport Services focuses on bringing their customers value by offering trailer rental equipment sales and new and used trailer sales, mobile repair, 30 plus service bays, and a parts distribution service. For more information, you can go to transportservices.com or contact Brian Brook at 330-573-0401. And as we start getting things ramped back up, the OTA offices opened up on Monday this week, and I would like to play a video of some of the things that we're doing in the office to make sure that we protect our guests and our members moving forward.
Like I said, this is BioShield, and so all we're doing is just misting on a really fine mist onto the chairs, doesn't hurt the textiles, doesn't hurt any of the materials. After this dries in about 5 minutes, it's going to lay down a little microscopic coating of spikes, and when a microbe falls down on that, literally it's pierced, it just gets sliced into the cell wall. That's how this product works. It's not doing a chemical kill, so it actually doesn't allow what they call superbugs or any specific microbe to survive that.
So as you'll see, there is a link there for matrixantimicrobial.com/OTA. We've got an exclusive link for our members to go ahead and purchase this product. It is a very cost-effective product. It lasts a very long time. It can be used in the cab, outside the cab, in the trailers, all throughout your offices. So it is a great product that is out there that is much better than just regular disinfectants. So it is available to us at the link, and it also went out in this morning's OTA Ohio Trucking Weekly. So that is available to you. So today with us, we're very, very happy to kick off this with Chris Spear. Chris is the president and CEO of the American Trucking Association, the nation's leading organization representing the interests of the trucking industry. Chris leads ATA's efforts in advocacy and education on behalf of the trucking industry, which employs over 7 million people and moving more than 10 billion tons of freight annually. The trucking industry is responsible for moving America's economy. Prior to his time at ATA, Chris served as a transportation, energy, labor, and technology sectors in five different continents. Most recently, Chris worked for Hyundai, where he served as the Vice President of Government Affairs. And prior to that, that role, he served on the Executive Committee for Global Automakers. Previously, Chris was ATA Senior Vice President of Legislative Affairs and Vice President of Global Government Relations for Honeywell International. So Chris, thanks for being with us, and thanks for all the work that you're doing on behalf of the industry in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Although you're not coming from us from D.C., we spoke Tuesday night, and you're out in Wyoming and in the beautiful country. So thanks for logging in.
Absolutely.
So I guess talk to us a little bit about what you've seen from the coronavirus, the impacts of that on the industry, and what we saw with the last 2 months worth of freight.
Sure. And thanks for all your membership and everything that you've done. The association's been a shining example of the partnership that we enjoy as a federation. And Ohio Trucking is clearly one of the leading indicators of how that partnership can and should function. So I appreciate that and the opportunity to be on. Let me begin by prefacing, where we started and where we are, because they're really two different universes. We began with two trade agreements, USMCA being ratified, agreement with China, and literally 50% of the negotiations that were ongoing going into this year. And those were two very promising benchmarks in terms of indicators for a uptick in freight as well as rates. And we anticipated at least the latter half of 2020 to be a much, much better place than the rut we were in 2019. Maybe close to, if not a full return to 2018 levels. And 2 months later, of course, we hit COVID and everything changed. We were 44 months of sub 4% unemployment. And now today, in just 2.5 months time, we have 42.65 million people on unemployment. So very impactful, not just directly on the industry, but very indirectly. All the businesses that we serve, particularly the mediums and the smalls, ranging from restaurants to fuel stations, have been really adversely impacted. So any company that's operating and serving those types of customers has certainly felt the immediate impact of COVID and what it has meant to us. We saw a number of immediate issues that arose that really aren't that surprising, but I think really speak to the strength, breadth, and depth of ATA as a federation, and why relationships between me and Tom, our teams, and the structure that we have between the federal and state as well as local have in mitigating problems that arise from, quite frankly, well-intended decisions from particularly governors and mayors when a crisis like this unfolds. We saw almost immediately states beginning to shut public rest areas from Pennsylvania, North Dakota, Nebraska, Arizona as examples. DMVs shut in multiple states, no renewals of CDLs, no issuance of CLPs, medical certificates. These were all immediate things that were going to serve as headwind to our ability to get from point A to B. Why does that matter? Obviously, restocking shelves quickly. We saw the depletion of shelves almost immediately as people went in and bought, 180 rolls of toilet paper. Why you need that much, debatable. But they definitely surged in consumption and, plenty of supply in the chain, but it took time to get those shelves restocked, as well as getting the PPE, the test kits, the medical supplies to the front lines, the EMTs, the nurses, the doctors. That all comes off a truck. And when you have states that are putting up, immediate requirements that prohibit us from seamlessly getting to those front lines, that was clearly an indicator that we, as an association working with Tom and his team, other neighboring states, if you're moving freight from Ohio to, say, New York, where first responders needed it, getting through Pennsylvania with shuttered public rest areas is a big deal. And we had to go in aggressively, work with our state executives, work with the governors, using our leverage at the federal level to get those policies overturned, get those public rest areas reopened, to accommodate exemptions at DMVs. We got exemptions at FMCSA from hours of service. We also got essential status almost immediately from the Department of Homeland Security, which was extraordinarily useful at the state and local levels. As governors made decisions, mayors created up boundaries, our ability to go in and explain that from a DHS point of view, that we have that status, that if you want those shelves restocked, you better accommodate interstate commerce, you better accommodate our industry, otherwise you're gonna have bigger problems on your hands. So a lot of whack-a-mole almost out of the gate, Tom, and I think we handled it well. Beyond that, the PPP payments to keep businesses afloat, not just our own, but many medium and small companies, we work with Congress to get that money moving. So we had liquidity in the marketplace to create a bridge from the crisis to the recovery. And that continues to be very essential, will continue to be an instrumental element in how quickly we can transition from crisis to full recovery. And then of course the PPE, the personal protective equipment for masks, sanitizer, We've now distributed in cooperation with FEMA, FMCSA, as well as ATA acquiring over 100,000 masks, a total of 1 million+ masks nationwide to our carriers, our drivers. We've also distributed hundreds of gallons of sanitizer that have been strategically placed throughout the country that are for free. You can come in as a driver, any driver. We don't say you have to be an OTA or an ATA member. Any driver can have access to fill their bottle and operate as safely as they possibly can during the crisis. So a lot of immediate action, a lot of people stepped up. We had from insurers donating the sanitizer to private truck stops, allowing us to distribute it. And so really a mix of teamwork, and really proud of that, and the creativity, the ingenuity that the industry brings to a crisis like this. It should come as no surprise why the president put our drivers on the South Lawn again last month and thank God for truckers, because he's absolutely right. It is all about our industry, gluing 71% of the freight shipped. And even in a crisis, we've proven that we can get the job done. And our image has probably reached epic levels that we never even thought possible because of it. And it's well-earned. Our drivers have done remarkably. And it's certainly been one for the books. We haven't anticipated anything like it, but I gotta say, proud to represent an industry like this that's able to step up and get the job done.
And I would agree. And that was actually my next question, is, you know, let's talk a little bit about, you know, the truck driver and the thank yous and the Girl Scout cookies and all the other things that have gone with that. You know, we've really seen this heightened level of emphasis on the value of the truck driver, which is something we've been battling for years. You know, how do we as an industry capitalize on that as things start progressing back? You know, how do we use that? What plans does ATA have in order to address that issue? And then we'll move on after that to the talk about the issue of the driver shortage.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, fundamentally, I think it's very important for our drivers that are out there away from their families, taking great risk in a crisis, to receive that kind of praise. This is what they do day in and day out anyway. It shouldn't take a world pandemic for that to happen, but we'll take it. It's great to see local communities across the country, you know, handing out free meals, bacon cookies, kids on overpasses with "I love trucks, thank you drivers." That really is well received by those that are out there making this happen. And, you know, from churches to Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, it really has solicited what makes this country great. And to have that channeled to our industry, our drivers, is something very special. Now, politically, strategically, what does that mean for us when we're moving legislation on the Hill for, say, additional COVID relief? We talked about the PPP and the payments and to keep businesses afloat with that liquidity, but there's also an opportunity to capitalize on other issues like liability and tort protections, which we're pushing very aggressively for. Infrastructure reform. We can speak to that later in detail, but we now have a House and Senate bill introduced and commitments to move it in the House this month. So, you know, key priority issues in the mix of a crisis, we never took our foot off the gas. We've seen, you know, opportunities to capitalize on that while maintaining and stepping up to the plate to deal with the crisis, both at the federal, state, and even local level. That pleases me to no end, because I think you channel that goodwill toward those that are making the decisions, and they see us on the South Lawn with the president. Literally, we had over 300 million public social media impressions a day after that event. By Monday, we had over 410 social media impressions from that White House event. A thank you to our drivers. You can't buy that kind of exposure. And so it creates a groundswell, an awareness, particularly with decision makers in states and Washington. And going in and knowing that we have that clout, that we have that leverage, allows us added momentum to get some of the things that we need, priority issues done. So believe you me, it's great to have that for our drivers. It's great for them to see it. But we've taken it to the next level and capitalized on that and moving some of our issues forward.
So obviously we've seen a contraction in the economy that's probably unprecedented. And you know, unfortunately, there's been some drivers that have been laid off and some issues that that have complicated that piece. What have you all seen as far as any numbers about driver shortages? And what are some of the concerns that we have in making sure that we re-employ those drivers and that piece moving forward?
Well, it's important that we don't allow this crisis, even the bridge from crisis to recovery, to dictate our future. And I said this repeatedly, I'll say it, you know, because it's true, but you can't make a temporary a crisis define, you know, what we're going to look like 5, 10, 15 years from now. And the projections that we had been running with going into this crisis, they're coming back. Yeah, we have a brief reprieve with the unemployment levels where they are. That's going to continue through the end of the year and probably through middle of next year, probably until Q3 of next year, until we regain the footing that we had coming into the crisis. And that's under the best of circumstances. But the long story short is it's temporary. So the problems that we had going into the crisis with the shortage of drivers and technicians will be back. It'll be back in a year, year and a half. And so we need to continue to seed plant solutions such as pilot programs for the youth, getting them properly trained to operate equipment, properly qualified, all the way to retaining people that are in their upper years closer to retirement, getting them good health care, keeping them healthy. We need to do more urban hiring, minorities, women. You know, we talk a lot right now in the protests in this environment with George Floyd's death about minorities. We're a very proud industry where the national average of employment is around 20, 21% for minorities. We're at 41%. We're double in our industry. That's a good story. That's a really, you have a home, you have a family, you have a place to work. If you're a minority in our industry, very proud of that. But if you're a woman, we're still hovering around 6-7% for drivers. That ain't good. We've got to do better. I think urban hiring is a place to do it. I think people in urban areas don't understand or see our industry as much. And working with our federal, state, and even mayors in the local cities, we have an opportunity to seize upon that and attract some of that talent that's currently looking for a future into our industry. And that's, again, I think goes back to, Tom, where we were with the leverage of public awareness about our industry, that good image, that goodwill. That translates into bringing good people into our industry as well. So I'm optimistic about that, but we cannot just say, oh, well, the driver shortage, technician shortage is over because of all the high unemployment. It will be back. This is temporary. And everything that we had done to date on that has been very long-term, like 5, 10, 15 years out. So I think we need to keep our eye on the ball there and keep committed to that issue.
So we're continually talking about driver treatment. Have you guys seen, or has there been any effort to work with shippers? Has it gotten better? Has it gotten worse? You know, we heard stories about, you know, the temp testing of drivers on the way in and no access to bathrooms and that side of thing. You know, what have you seen as far as the shipping community and the receiving community's treatment of drivers during this crisis?
We have shippers as members of ATA. We did go individually out to them when we began getting some feedback from motor carriers that they were having issues, detention time, rates, a lot of issues that they felt were unjust during the crisis, where the priority really needed to be on getting particularly the medical equipment, the test kits, all the supplies to the front lines. You know, having impediments where if you're sitting in detention time and you have a load that's non-medical related and you're waiting 8 hours to get it, your next load could be medical equipment. And that's time on the clock. That's time that's being taken away from getting that next load as a priority load to medical first responders. And so, you know, looking at it in that lens, detention is very important. It always has been, but it certainly is in a crisis. It cannot hold up drivers indefinitely. In terms of rates, in terms of any manipulation, the feedback that we were getting from a number of those shippers, particularly in e-commerce, is that they were going actually in the other direction. They weren't putting strain. They were actually easing it up and making it better to ensure that drivers, motor carriers, you know, were being treated fairly, even better than they were before the crisis in some respects, in terms of rates and time. But we've had instances as well that have flagged this issue. Our survey does not indicate that it's widespread at this time. However, it could be, and it's something that we need to keep focused on, because nobody should be taken advantage in a situation like this. The priority one is to make certain that, you know, the emergency folks have what they need, that those store shelves are restocked, that people and consumers have food and things to drink and medicine and access to it. And beyond that, you know, we need to make certain that we're in a position to serve our customers on the back end of this. So keeping an eye on it, I think, is very important, but I haven't seen it yet as widespread, which is encouraging.
Good. Switch gears a little bit, talk about Congress. You know, Congress has obviously spent a great deal of time on coronavirus response and PPP and unemployment insurance, and they've been spending a lot of money. Has there been discussion in D.C. about the pay-fors? Like, how are they going to finance all of this obviously necessary spending, but to keep the economy going? But has there been discussion about what that looks like on the other end of how this is all going to get paid for?
No, not at all. Not even a close. Look, I'll start by giving a shout out to Congress, because, you know, the speed that both chambers, in an extraordinarily politically divided environment that we're in. We were in that before COVID, and it was getting worse regardless of COVID going into November. So I give them a shout out for being able to put over $3 trillion into the economy. That liquidity has been essential in keeping, you know, people afloat long enough that we can make the recovery. And I got to say, if we don't have medium, particularly medium and small businesses to serve, we're not going to be in business. OTA is not going to have members. ATA is not going to have members. They're not going to be around. So the ability to survive this really hinges on having customers on good, sound footing. And I think the relief liquidity that they provided has been absolutely essential to that. Now, that's my shout out. Let me go the other direction. You cannot keep putting money like this, $3+ trillion on the government credit card without any consideration of its impact on our kids, our grandkids. They're going to be picking up the tab. It is amazing to me, being a Republican, I feel like I can really pick on my own here, but it's truly the conservatives, particularly those, and I am one, particularly those that took no new revenue pledges before they came into office. They've already violated that with the debt relief. Piling on the debt and providing the COVID relief. So they've already violated that. But when we come to the table with a paid for infrastructure bill, 5 cents on the gallon over 4 years, 20 cents with gas prices nationally at historic lows. I got gas here in Wyoming. I've got gas I've seen in the Ozarks at 99 cents a gallon. And when you get that low, 5 cents a year built in at the rack, you aren't even going to notice it. 4 years of that, 20 cents total, is going to get you $340 billion in new revenue over 10 years. Immediate, right in the trust fund, shores up the trust fund, and doesn't add a dime to the debt. And you'd think that we were just, you know, calling for the unheard. It is unbelievable how reluctant, particularly conservatives, are to raise revenue, because they don't want to violate these no new revenue pledges. Yet they're quick to put $3 trillion on the credit card. That's got to stop. We've got to call these guys out and say, enough's enough. You cannot have it both ways, where you want to chicken out and not take a hard vote, the right vote, to do what's good for the economy, good for jobs. Right now in a crisis, I can't think of a better issue than infrastructure, and fund it, pay for it. But you'll be quick to put $3 trillion on the credit card. You just can't have it both ways. So we have been really echoing that up on the Hill. I think it has to continue, and we're going to have to, come November, hold people accountable on this.
And you talk about it when we go on the no pay fors. Well, you know, obviously the infrastructure bill is always an interesting animal, because it always seems to have a lot of spending in it, but no pay fors in it. You know, the House and Senate both came out with their versions. The House version came out, as I understand, without any Republican input. Compare and contrast, what is the thoughts on the Hill about infrastructure spending and infrastructure bills? Are they going to CR it for the next, 3 years like they have in the past? Like, give us a flavor for what you're hearing as far as infrastructure spending.
When I talk about this issue, know that I really don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican. I just want the issue to move forward. And so we're going to work with anybody that works with us, that aligns with us on our priority issue set. So political color does not matter to me on this matter, on this issue. The Senate last year was able to produce a third of their bill, what's called the Environment Public Works Committee. And that accounts for about a third of the overall authorization. This would replace the current FAST Act, which is set to expire this September, which speaks to your point about CR and whether or not they just extend that. They've got to add the safety piece, which was in Senate Commerce. They haven't done that yet. And they have to add the Banking Committee piece, which is the transit. Transit falls under the Banking Committee. So there's three committees that have to authorize it. And then you need the Finance Committee, the fourth committee in the Senate, to actually pay for it, which they haven't done. So three out of four committees haven't done anything yet, only one. And that's not infrastructure. They like to couch it that way, that they're pro-infrastructure, but you've only done a third of the bill and you haven't paid for it. Over on the House side, they introduced the lion's share of that bill in the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee just yesterday. Overall, it's a pretty good bill. It does track pretty much everything that we want to see. There's some stuff that we'll have to hold our nose to, but you're not going to have a bill that big that's going to be perfect. So let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. House Ways and Means is going to look at how to fund it. I do firmly believe that they will roll with a increase in the fuel tax. The user fee should be paid by users, and that tracks very closely if they do that with what we've been advocating. So here's a situation where it looks like the House bill paid for may be more aligned with ATA policy than the Senate bill. I personally believe that they're more inclined to authorize it, but not pay for it. Well, that doesn't mean anything for us. You can authorize all you want. If you don't pay for it, it doesn't mean anything to us. It's not free. It's not cheap. And these guys need to get off their butts and do their jobs. We do ours every day. They need to do theirs. And I am optimistic that the House will mark up their bill on the 16th of June. They are expected to take a floor vote on the bill July 1. I am hopeful that we will have by then an understanding how they're going to pay for it. If the president sees that the business community and organized labor, which so far has been very united on this issue and how to do it, if the president sees that the support is trending toward the House product, assuming all those pieces fall in place, I think he might go with the House bill and the Senate will have to capitulate. So strategically, I think that is the best play, because I just personally don't believe the Senate has any desire to vote on any funding. So, to play it there, it's just meaningless. I think your best play is in the House and getting the president on board. And we might be able to get that done this year. We'll see.
So the FMCSA just issued the new hours of service rule. What's your thoughts? Where's ATA's position on that? Did we get some movement on some things we were looking for?
It definitely tracks four of the five pieces that we expected to be in the final rule. It's going to be some time before it's made effective, well over a year. And we're running it, channeling it through our safety policy committee. So there'll be a lot of opportunity going into October when we next meet to cover that. It had come out around the time of our mid-year meeting this last month. And so there was a lot of talk about it. So there really wasn't any surprises in it. And I do think there are parts and pieces that are pretty appealing that do provide the flexibility that we're looking for. Again, this is another one of those, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. There's going to have to be some compromise in here. You mentioned ELDs earlier, Tom. I would just be quick to point out that there is some history driving why this rule came to be. And it dates back about, three, 4 years ago when Trump was elected. He came in and really adopted an anti-regulatory approach, and mindful that ELDs had already been law for 5 years. The courts had decided that this was going to go forward and the rule was about to go into effect. and that was 2018, December. And there was a concerted push to leverage the anti-regulatory theme of the administration to take the rule down. Well, it wasn't up to the administration, it was legislated. So the only way to take it down was on the Hill. And they made a run at it. And we had already adopted for 5 years ELDs. It was an accepted technology. People had invested, they had trained to it. So to then turn around 5 years later and take it down, for a lot of companies would have been a huge loss. Not just the safety, but the investment in the tech and the training. And my argument to the Hill is, wait a minute, you guys voted for this. Three Republican Congresses voted for this and got it signed into law in three different bills. And now they wanted to turn around and say, oh, we really didn't mean that. And so we beat that last effort by over 70 votes. Probably would have been more, but it was pretty close in that sense that they had momentum to take the whole thing down. OIDA led that effort, and we fought it. Those lines were pretty well drawn when I took this job, but we won that fight. But part of the compromise that kept the votes in place, particularly in the Senate, was that the agency, FMCSA, would do an hours of service rule. We kept saying, look, ELDs does not change the amount of hours you can drive. It just changes how you record them. We went from paper to electronic. That's it. So if you really want flexibility, you got to focus on hours of service. And that's what resulted, Tom, in the rule. That's why we have the rule that we have right now, is to keep it from unraveling the ELD requirement. And so the little bit of history that dates back, that this just wasn't hatched out of nowhere. There was a lot of background that played into this decision and why we have the rule we have.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that was one of the pieces, and I've said that for years, that the call for more flexibility, trusting drivers to make the calls and the decisions they need to make, all relied on the agency having a very high level of certainty that they were doing and following the regulation as best they could, and ELD allowed them that opportunity to do that. That there was a less likelihood of fabrication on those, and that opened that definitely opened that door. So let's talk a little bit about the economy. Obviously things are not great. Everyone's kind of throwing a dart at a dartboard. You know, on this show, when this was the COVID update, we've had a number of economists and trucking folks on, and they all brought a variety of stuff. But what are you seeing? What's the econ shop at ATA seeing? What are some of the things that we can look forward to in the future when it comes to the economy?
Certainly. Well, I think the degree of optimism is there, and it's driven largely indifferent to 08-09, because the circumstances coming into this crisis are driven. This is a healthcare crisis that resulted in an economic crisis. If you look at 08-09, that was all economic, global, not just domestic. And we came into 08 very weak, and it took a lot of time to come out of it as a result. We came into this crisis spurred by a healthcare pandemic, nonetheless, but we came into it with 44 weeks of sub 4% unemployment, historic. That had never happened in decades. And so we were really strong coming into this. And that does suggest that despite the massive surge in unemployment insurance claims, now at 42.6 million, and those numbers will be formalized tomorrow, by the Labor Department, that a lot of those jobs are going to return rather quickly. And a lot of them in the service sector, restaurants particularly. And, we will see a lot of that recouped almost very quickly, hopefully by the end of the year. And, Labor Secretary Gene Scalia spoke at our executive committee meeting in January down in Florida. And he was just on this morning, and he made very clear that he felt by the end of the year, from their projections, that we will be well under 9% unemployment by the end of the year. And that puts us on a trajectory for next year, probably third quarter 2021, to be back down where we were before the crisis. Now that has a lot of contingencies attached to it, but the fact that we were so strong coming into it, We have those trade agreements already in place. USMCA kicks in full effect, Mexico, Canada, US, July 1. So less than a month. So we have a lot of foundation pieces that just can't be dismissed. And I think the protest and a lot of that has served as a bit of a temporary distraction. It's clearly driven by other priorities in honoring the death of George Floyd. I fully respect that. But I wouldn't look at that from an economic point of view to be a long-term indicator. It's certainly consuming right now people's attention. But we need to look at, panoramically at how we came into this, where we are, and how quickly we believe from that we can come out of it. I'd say by Q3, Q4 of next year, we will be back and tracking pre-COVID levels.
Let's talk a little bit. So how does the, when Bill Clinton got elected, he ran on it's the economy stupid model, right? How does this all play out when it comes to the election?
Oh man, I wish I had a good answer for that. I really don't. I mean, I honestly, looked at the modeling going into the last election. Trump brought in a whole host of people that had never voted before. So polls meant nothing. Your projections, your predictions, commentary, pundits, useless, absolutely useless. They all got it wrong. And the question now is, do the people that he brought in the last round show up again? Do they show up in greater numbers? Particularly, do they show up in the states that he has to win? He's down over 9 points in 3 battleground states right now. Biden's ahead. Biden really hasn't done a thing for the last 2.5 months. He's sat at home in Delaware and weathered the COVID crisis. Don't fault him for that, but that's interesting when you play it out. He has not been on the trail. Trump hasn't either, but he's used COVID every day to have those press conferences almost as a surrogate to campaign rallies. People see him, he's out there, he's talking about issues. Love it or hate it, that is interfacing with the electorate. Biden's done none of that. So it's interesting when you break that down to see Biden leading by that much in certain battleground states when he really hasn't done anything. That might be a strategy. Just continue to do nothing and you keep climbing. I don't know. There's just so many factors that I don't think there's a lot of data or thought behind why that's happening the way it is. We had COVID from crisis to recovery. We have the tragic death of George Floyd, resulting in protests, now riots nationwide, curfews put in place to contain the rioting and the looting. I think economically that's temporary, but it definitely is shaping public opinion around issues that weren't on the table just a month ago. We're now back to racial inequity. We're focused on injustice across the country, both federal, state, and local. These were issues that weren't even be talked about just weeks ago. Now we're front and center. So I'm just describing anything can change between now and November. Expect the unexpected, but I think it's going to be pretty close, to say the least. I really do. It's going to be a tight race, and we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, and the interesting part is going to be which states have polls actually physically open, which states go to mail-in vote. I mean, it just this is one of those that anytime I ever get asked about elections, about anything, I'll be honest with you. I'm glad it's here in Ohio, it's an off year for the big offices, the statewide offices, because it is, who knows what's going to play out here in the next few months to get us to the election.
You're going to have a lot of litigation. Already see that in states like California on the absentee ballot, voting remote. There's a constitutional question there and it's already being litigated. I think we have a long way to go to November. A lot's going to change. I think, you start to see economic uptick. The market doesn't seem to reflect any this past week. It's been up pretty much the whole week. And I don't understand any of that. I really don't. There's probably a whole host of forces there that need to be analyzed, but probably won't even be known until after November. But I do know that this president is a fierce campaigner. His approach, while not well received by everybody, this sort of divide, division and really go on the attack, may play well, may hurt him. We're going to definitely know by November. I can tell you this, we will work with whoever is elected. We have already begun outreach to the Biden campaign in preps for transition. We did that before in 16 with the Clinton campaign, so that we were prepared in both camps, regardless of who won. Because the bottom line is, I can't take 4 years off. I can't be on the defensive for 8 years because we didn't position to work with them. We have to work with whoever is in charge. The issues that govern us are just simply too, you know, significant to ignore. And we've got 8 departments in Washington, D.C. that oversee us. You can't dismiss it. I have to work with the House majority. You know, it just doesn't matter who's in charge. We have to be at the table and in a position to work with them, whether they're Republican or not. So, you know, we'll position for that. We'll see where it goes and posture after and go from there.
Let's talk a little bit about the mid-year meeting that you all just recently had, obviously a much, much different flavor than we're used to. I guess talk to us a little bit and update us on that process and what happened, and then also give us your thoughts on what MC&E looks like.
Great questions. Clearly uncharted waters. I mean, we'd never encountered anything like that to host a meeting of that size and scope with that many, you know, subset gatherings, multiple policy committees leading up to the exec committee and the board. And to do it electronically, it certainly caused a lot of angst with me. We were set to be in Tucson. I firmly believe, I'm sure you share this, Tom, at OTA, that we're a high-touch business. There is a degree of interaction that is required that makes our industry special, and that's the relationships, the trust, the dependency that we have on one another. When we procure equipment, for instance, or services, you want that interaction to be face-to-face, and that's got to continue in spite of this environment we're in. You know, we need to get back to that eventually, but during the crisis, it just didn't permit us to do this live, and so we created our own platform within ATA. We taught our policy chairs and officers how to operate this equipment and the software. So there was a lot of background that went into it leading up to mid-year that was instrumental and I think really paid off. We had attendance, and just judge it by the numbers, we rarely had a policy committee meeting that didn't crack 100. Safety policy committee was over 320. It was unbelievable. We had great guest speakers from agency heads like Jim Mullen at FMCSA, to the EPA and so on, as well as DHS and DOD. So really pleased with the guests that took time to come on. And our board meeting also cracked 300. I don't honestly recall the last time we had that many there. So people took it over the course of 5 days, what was used to be 3 when we did it live. That was kind of cool because even myself, I like to go to a lot of the meetings as many as I can, and sometimes they overlap. So I can only go to 1 when I'd like to go to 3. This actually allowed me to go to all of them. And so we got really high marks for allowing people to interact in policy discussions that they wouldn't normally attend at a live meeting. So I would imagine, Tom, that we'll probably be doing more of this. It's not going to take the place of the interaction we need. But we'll certainly, it's a mark of success, and it's something that we'll be looking at going forward to see how we can connect more via virtual like this. MC&E is, as opposed to mid-year, is the last week of October. And yeah, it's a bit of a gamble, but I'm rolling the dice that COVID will certainly be less of a factor from where we're at, and any resurgence wouldn't happen until the back end. So I'm optimistic that we will have a nice window to host at the Gaylord, the new Gaylord, by the airport in Denver, very easy to get in and out of. So long as the governor of Colorado and the mayor of Denver are cooperative and we don't have any headwind, we're looking good. We opened up registration. You do not have to pay till September. We encourage people to register now. And the reason why is I want to show vendors, I want to show our allied members that we have a good showing of motor carriers coming. And right now, I got my latest numbers. We are almost perfectly aligned with where we were in 2019 for registration. So that indicates to me we're going to have a great turnout. And I'm looking forward to, honestly, I'm really looking forward to seeing you, Tom, and your members in Denver, and an opportunity to tip a glass and you know, breathe a sigh of relief that hopefully we're past this.
Yeah, good. And just for the folks on the call, would be remiss if I didn't remind them of our annual conference, which is September 21st and 22nd, where our keynote speaker is going to be Archie Griffin. So we look forward. That'll be the warm up to MC&E. So I'm going to go to some Q&A for those of you on Zoom. Just go to your Q&A section and type those in. One of the questions was, with the goodwill towards the industry at this time, do you think it would be appropriate for something to be done about the crash indicator with CSA, specifically the not at fault accidents counting against carriers? Remains a large issue and has drug on far too long without any results.
Yeah, this like ELDs has some history, FAST Act history. It was put in FAST Act, which expires again in September, our current highway bill, that the CSA scores of the program be taken down. And there were a lot of flaws with the program. It's not a regulation, it's a program actually. And conceptually, we feel very strongly that it's a good thing to have a report card out there that people can judge. We take safety very serious. We take performance serious. But the way that it was working, we had instances where a deficient bridge collapsed on a truck, and it was counted against the truck and the driver. Now, that just is absurd. And we've had multiple citations of that. So that the program was taken down to fix those things. It's been down way too long. There have been proposals to go to an IRT system. Whether that ends up the case, we'll see soon. I have had very, very recent discussions with Jim Mullen and his staff. This is a priority. They are coming up on the expiration of the FAST Act. They will be need to testify themselves on where they are with issues like CSA before the House and Senate in the coming weeks. And so they are positioning actually very aggressively to fix CSA and get it back up online. And so I think there's going to be some flexibility put in there to make these scores more reflective of reality, but still capture the essence of what the program was intended to do. But I do know they're working on it. I know they're working very quickly and that they hope to have a solution this year in place. So, you know, we're tracking that. I don't have more detail on what that's gonna look and feel like quite yet, but I can tell you, we should expect some movement very soon on it.
It's good. Yeah, the that bridge happened to be in right here in Ohio, on the north side of Cincinnati.
I should take credit for that. I
know. Right, exactly. You know, it definitely shows the challenges that that particular metric has, and the other, you know, the classic example is you're stopped somewhere and you get rear-ended, and at the time then FMCSA administror. Her response was, well, maybe your truck shouldn't have been there. And that it's nice to have some folks that we can talk to in that same vein. So,
yep.
Alrighty, so our Q&A is clear. That was the only question that we had. Chris, as always, great talking with you. Thank you so much for being our inaugural guest on OTA on the Air. You've always been a very diverse leader who can really guide us through some of these very difficult times, and a great partner to the Ohio Trucking Association, and we very much appreciate it.
Well, Tom, you're a great leader, a great partner, and I love your members. I've always enjoyed coming to Ohio to speak, and I look forward to doing that again live. I just can't dismiss the importance of that high touch. But I'll tell you, we've done very well in the interim with the electronic means, and I really appreciate your hosting this platform and for having me on. So, hope to see many of you in Denver. And until then, keep trucking.
Great. Well, we will see everyone next Thursday at noon, where we'll have Steve McCormick with the FMCSA on, who's the state administrator for the state of Ohio. Chris, again, thank you. And we'll talk to you all next week.